Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and assistant editor Lee Boyce today is pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, more shocking cases in the $3 billion state pension scandal. So Steve Webb will be joining us to discuss the latest. Meanwhile, do you know what your pension is invested in and what it's worth? It might matter even more than usual if the Chancellor gets his way and taps into our retirement pots to help pay for the pandemic. We also discuss the new green savings bond from NS&I. How long is the term? What's the rate? And just how green are they? There's a chink of light for easy access accounts. And, well, if you will leave Lee and I to sort out the pod alone, we will find a way to talk about football. Don't worry, it is money related. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, sadly, we suspected that there would be cases like this in the wake of the state pension scandal, but it is still shocking to read. Two bereaved daughters have received sums of £42,000 and £71,000 that should have gone to their mums to give them a comfortable retirement. But they died in the 90s, having been underpaid their state pensions for more than a decade. In one case, DWP was repeatedly asked to review a retired teacher's £10 a week state pension from 2017 onwards. Her efforts got her nowhere before her death 3 years ago, aged 93. And her daughter also got the brush off until she wrote to former pensions minister Steve Webb via his This Is Money column, and he intervened personally in the case. Well, Steve joins us now with Tanya. Before we get to that particularly shocking case, Steve, Tanya, just briefly remind us of the scandal. We've talked about it quite a lot on the podcast, but just give us an idea of the material impact that this has been having on people's lives.
Okay, just to recap on what happened, over a year ago, a lady and a husband wrote into Steve's column, which started our investigation into why women seem to be underpaid really large sums in state pension. It's had a really huge effect on people's lives. Some of the people who we've dealt with have been very badly off. Others have been well off, but have expressed outrage on behalf of people who are less well off than them, to be honest. They've thought of others. They've said, this is really nice to have, but I think of all the others who've gone on without it. Early in the investigation, we pressed the government to investigate itself, and eventually, I think in the second half of last year, it said that it was looking into it. And that culminated on Budget Day this year with the government announcing that it estimates £3 billion must have been underpaid. That is a lot more than we had ever imagined. And it's obviously a very serious issue for a lot of people who are still out there not knowing anything about this, have not been contacted, have not heard about it, and are probably labouring on very small state pensions or even no state pension at all.
Steve, tell us about your involvement in this.
Well, with these most recent families, we're talking about daughters of ladies who died in their 90s, and they've often read the coverage on This Is Money or have read it somewhere else and have thought, well, actually, that sounds, maybe that's something to do with my mum. And the government have said they will put things right even where people have now died. So this is something that we're hearing a lot now from sons and daughters, as it were. And I mean, one of these cases, I think it's Mrs. Taylor, and her daughter got in touch and said, my mum was on a pension of a tenner a week. And you kind of immediately think, well, A, how does anyone live on a tenner a week? And the answer was, well, she was a retired teacher, so she had a teacher's pension, she had a tenner a week, and she just got by. She made do, you know, and people, it's astonishing. It's a generation that just did that. They didn't complain. And what was amazing about this one was that the daughter had written to DWP and said, how's this been worked out? Why is my mom getting tenner a week? And I saw the letter she got back, which was pages and pages of calculations and this, that, and the other explaining the 10 quid, but missing the elephant in the room that was another 80 odd quid she should have been getting and hadn't for the last decade or more. And, you know, I think there's a training issue quite a bit. You know, I don't think the government wakes up in the morning and thinks, how can we deprive people of their money? I just think they don't train people properly in this really complicated system.
Well, what have they been telling you? What are they going to do about this going forward?
Well, what they've said is that there's no sort of claim form. It's not like families, if they look hard enough on the internet, will find a claim form. The DWP, to be honest, don't want people phoning up because they've got a huge number of cases to go through. So what they've done is do a massive trawl of hundreds of thousands of records, identified getting on for 200,000, mostly women, a few men, mostly women, where they think there's probably an error. and they've employed 500 plus civil servants to spend the next 2.5 years of their lives, case by case, going through, seeing where there are errors. And in principle, these families could wait for a check. People are sceptical, understandably. You know, would the couple, the families we're talking about today, would they ever have actually got these checks? Given that they already had a letter saying everything was fine, how can we be sure they're actually going to pick it up this time around? And just finally, DWP are being so secretive about all of this. I mean, the figures that Tanya mentioned were published on Budget Day, but not by the DWP, by the Office for Budget Responsibility, because they had to put a number in a chart. DWP is still refusing to tell us what's going on, who they're prioritising, when people will hear. They've just got to be more open.
As a former pensions minister, are you quite horrified by that? You would know better than any of us here how the whole inner machinations of government and policy and all that sort of thing work. Are you really disappointed?
Very much so. I mean, I don't, you know, the current pensions minister came in and the problem was already there. It's not his fault that it happened. I was a pensions minister. It was happening on my watch. I didn't know. You know, we all, frankly, are in this thing together. But it, now that it's been identified and pointed out, not only should they be doing as they are, putting a lot of resource into fixing it, but they should be transparent. They should be explaining what's going on. They should be giving us updates. And instead, the shutters have come down. They say, I will give you an update in November in the budget and so on. And, you know, there are so many questions. And my biggest question is actually, have they got everybody? You know, they've done this trawl, they've got this list, but when we find a new case, do they check if it's on the list? And if the new case we found isn't on the list, do they think, well, maybe we haven't done our list right and do another trawl? You know, we just don't know.
Yeah. What do you reckon, Tanya?
Well, we've looked at cases, like Steve says, where we don't think they're going to be picked up by this trawl. Steve's been looking particularly into cases of a zero state pension, when people are getting nothing at all, where it looks like they won't be covered by this at all. There's obviously also the women whose husbands are retired before 2008. They're not covered. Divorcees really need to be proactive as well. Steve, perhaps you could mention a little bit more about the zero cases, because from what I understand, there's some really varied cases of people who are not getting anything, really interesting cases of people who are not getting anything. They really, if they're listening to this, or someone is listening to this who knows someone who is not getting a state pension, it is probably worth following up.
Absolutely. I mean, the headline message would be, if you're over pension age and not getting a pension, don't assume you're not entitled. The number of people we hear from, you think, well, you know, you say you're not getting a pension, why didn't you apply? Oh, I didn't think I was entitled. So I've had a lady who's 100 years old living in a care home on zero pension. And I'm pretty sure she could have been getting a pension for the last 17 years. And her 79-year-old daughter contacted me, and we're now trying to get that sorted. I've had a lady who's been married 4 times, but she was divorced when she retired. So her pension should have been assessed on her ex-husband's, her third ex-husband's contributions. Never happened. She never applied. That's now being fixed. She'll probably get tens of thousands back. And we ran a story only, I think, last week in the column, where a gentleman was in his 70s and said, well, I thought I probably wasn't entitled. And he could have had a basic pension for the last 6 years. He'll probably get tens of thousands. So it's astonishing that all these people, particularly over 80, who you don't need a national insurance record. You just need to have lived here 10 years and you get 80 quid a week. You know, it's so baffling. People don't understand. And our message is ask the question, make an application. The worst that they can say is you're not entitled.
Well, yeah, how can you check? I mean, is it as simple as if I haven't got 80 quid, then clearly something's wrong, or?
Well, the over 80s is a very specific group where, amazingly, we have what I call almost a citizen's pension. You know, most of our pensions are based on national insurance or your husband's national insurance or something like that. But once you're 80, under the old state pension system, you are entitled to £82.45 a week, category D, non-contributory. All these words don't mean anything, but, you know, 82 quid a week, as long as you've lived in the country for 10 years. I mean, it's a bit more subtle than that, but that's basically it. So I am convinced there are hundreds of thousands of people on zero pensions. And the point about these women is, if they were not on a pension at 79.5, the government doesn't contact them at 80 and say, why don't you claim? They don't get the money until they claim. And that's why, as Tanya points out, as far as DWP are concerned, there's no error in these cases. They'll give them the money if they ask for it, but they have to ask for it.
Mm. What about the sad cases that you've been talking about, two deceased ladies? I mean, what about that? If you are you think that your deceased parent has missed out, what do you do?
Well, I mean, another of the ladies that, and you know, all credit to Tanya, who really goes the extra mile with these families and spends time talking to them and really makes sure that they get justice, and think she deserves huge credit for that. But, you know, one of the ladies, her husband died in 2009, so she's a widow on about £80 a week. Her daughter, you know, I think again, read the coverage, thought that couldn't be right, didn't know what to do, contacted us, and, you know, she's got 70-odd thousand pounds in back pension. And she kind of knew, you know, she talked to her mom, she got power of attorney, I think, or she, you know, she was involved in her mom's finances, and she kind of knew there was something wrong but didn't quite know what to do. So one of the messages from us is, you know, even if you haven't got everything, even if you don't know chapter and verse, national insurance numbers and all the rest of it, just make some inquiry, you know, contact the DWP, at least make sure they've got your contact details. Because, of course, if they find an error for someone who's died, who are they going to write to? How do they know who to write to? At least if you make sure they've got the contact details of the heirs, they've got somebody to actually engage with.
Why are they not paying interest on it?
Well, it's a strange one, this. So last year, when we were finding individual cases, they'd say, oh, yeah, it's a fair cop, they've been underpaid, and will pay what they call a special payment, which is essentially interest. It's discretionary, but they've been paying interest. When they started in January being systematic, you know, 190,000 cases, they said, right, we're switching that off, because when we do these systematic cases, we don't ever pay interest. And I think that's a bureaucratic thing. It's just, it would take too much time and effort. They can't be bothered almost. And then these specific cases, because one of the ladies was told she would get interest and then told she wouldn't. And what they said was, we basically don't pay it where people are deceased. You know, the interest is kind of to help the living. It's not to pay into the estate. But, you know, the family have lost out. The family probably supported the parent while they were living on a tenner a week pension. So why shouldn't they get interest?
Indeed. Tanya, yes, very good work on this, both of you. I want to ask, there's a few issues that get thrown up here if you do get a back payment, is inheritance tax and what you pay for care. Let's go with inheritance tax first. Does it impact?
It can do if you're liable for inheritance tax. As part of this investigation, we got a tax accountant to go into all the details. Obviously, all the usual rules on inheritance tax would apply. But the crucial bit here is, depending on how long ago your parent died, you might have to reopen the whole question of inheritance tax. If you think this might affect you, I urge you to go and read the piece that's on our site at the moment by an accountant, which goes into depth on this issue. There is a potential issue if you have to reopen it and pay more inheritance tax, that there's interest of a couple of percent on that. Now, this accountant says if this does happen, then definitely go to an accountant and get some help, because you should be able to fight the interest on the basis, challenge it on the basis that this large back payment that has, you know, changed your inheritance tax bill came about through no fault of your own. It was through government error, so you shouldn't be penalised. In those situations, it's best to get a professional on your side. Mm. When it comes to the care home fees, it's a lot less clear what is going to happen, because with tax, thankfully early on the Treasury came out and said how it was going to be treating these back payments for tax, and the inheritance tax situation is also pretty clear. With care home fees, it's often down to the way local authorities interpret the rules. And we have got a legal expert who's written a piece for us. So again, anybody who thinks they might be in this situation should read this specific piece where he goes into depth about it. He thinks that under the law that they would have to treat this back payment as income, which it would have been if paid correctly at the right time. So a local authority won't be able to say, oh, you've now got 70 grand, for example. That puts you well over the capital requirement. You're a self-funder now, and so on. That they will have to be look at it a lot more closely. I'm not getting any indication. We did ask the government to comment on this. We're not getting any indication that they're going to necessarily intervene with local authorities. It, again, might come down to individuals having to challenge it, in which case, if it's a serious amount of money involved, it might be a good idea to see a specialist lawyer to fight their corner. We're definitely going to carry on investigating the issue with care funding, because obviously with potentially 200,000 elderly ladies who will need care, are in care, had care if they've already died, this is going to be a really big issue. It's going to come up again and again. People have already written to us before this. One of these cases today involved care funding. So we will report on developments.
Steve?
Yes, I think it is frustrating for people. There is this sort of ambiguity. I mean, as Tanya said, at least we've got a clear answer on income tax and on inheritance tax. But on care, it's this, we think we know that, as Tanya says, you get the lump sum. They won't say, oh, that's a big lump sum. You're completely disqualified. We think they will treat it as if it was income when it should have been paid. What we're still a bit unclear about is, will they go back 3 years and say, well, it's now apparent that 3 years ago you got a bigger pension than we took account of. We gave you help with your care costs 3 years ago, so we want some of that back. The expert that Tanya's commissioned to write thinks they probably shouldn't. But just because local authorities probably shouldn't doesn't mean local authorities don't. So we are going to have to keep a close eye on this and hopefully spread some good practice. So if we get local authorities doing it right and treating people fairly, and then we get people living in other areas, it's like a lottery as far as we can see at the moment, and hopefully we can help ensure some standardisation.
Steve, before I let you go, one final question on this, because to my mind and listening to you both now, it doesn't seem to be the case, but DWP talk about training, specific training for these cases. Have lessons really been learnt? And I don't just mean with the DWP, across the board, because this just seems to be failures on multiple levels.
I worry, Georgie, that they haven't been, because my question was always, you know, I have no doubt that for the last 20 years, one at a time, people have rung up and said, I'm on the wrong pension. And they've gone and had a look and said, oh dear, oh yes, you are. And they fixed it. And then the next week, somebody else rang up and nobody ever said, hang on a minute, we get a lot of these, don't we? What's going on? And it's really only this last 12 months that anybody systematically looked at this. The culture is always you fix the case in front of you. And if you are a busy civil servant with 50 cases to do today, that's your job. You're expected to do that. And the role, I think, of leaders in the pension service, ministers like me in the past, is to take the overview and see if the system is working. And, you know, what went wrong in this case is things changed. A woman was widowed, she turned 80, her husband retired, and her system, her pension should have been changed, and it wasn't. There was a trigger that wasn't acted on. Well, this can't be the only bit of the system where there are triggers not acted on. So the worry is, and what the government should now be doing, is saying, well, if it happened here, where else is it happening?
We hope, Steve. Thank you so much. And in the meantime, you will both work very hard in trying to uncover more cases like this. And well done for all the work you've done so far. Steve, thank you very much for joining us. We will let you go now.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much to Steve there. We're going to stick with pensions because meanwhile, as the furlough scheme and stamp duty holiday started to taper off this week, the government are left with a new job of figuring out how on earth we're going to pay for all this almighty coronavirus bill. Could pensions be tapped? Treasury officials have held private talks over plans to channel tens of billions of pounds of pension money into infrastructure and startup companies to boost the economic bounce back. How would it work, and is it a good idea? Tanya, it was interesting. I was listening to Spanish radio this morning and they were talking about how they're going to pay for it. They're going to make people work longer, or you're going to have a less rich pension. It seems across Europe, people are trying to figure out ways in which we're going to pay for this. And it seems pensions are the victim.
Well, not necessarily the victim. I mean, there's been various ideas knocking about, including changing the triple lock on state pensions, changing the pension tax breaks. That could end up penalising some people. But the specific issue that you're talking about now is this idea that seems to be knocking around about taking a portion of the of what people have got invested in their default pension fund. So we're talking about people who are saving at the moment, and putting that in some kind of long-term investment fund, which will be used to kickstart the economy, basically. There's various pros and cons to doing that, but this particular idea doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to lose out, because it might be invested successfully. We often hear high risk, high reward. Some of these projects might be high risk, but on the other hand, they might be high reward. We might end up with bigger pensions, is what I'm saying here.
Well, let's hope so. But Lee, we have welcome, hi Lee. We have heard quite a few proposals. This is just one of what we could do with our pensions. Lots of ideas swilling around.
Well, we've got a couple of trillion pounds floating around in pension pots, so you can see why the attraction might be to be having a look at what could be done with some of that money and funneling it into things that, you know, help shape our future economy and infrastructure projects and all that kind of thing. And actually, in the last year, we've seen all sorts of like moves towards this kind of way of doing things. So we've had this UK infrastructure bank that's been set up in Leeds recently. We've got these green bonds that are being issued shortly, which we'll talk about in a bit. But you've got to think about the vast scale of pension savings, right? And they're looking at this and thinking, well, you know, if you're invested in a pension, you're invested in the stock market, a lot of people don't engage with their pension, so we're in a default fund. So inevitably, it's going to be, if they go down that route and make this a deep part of a default fund, unless you opt out, you're going to be involved in this. You know, if this actually got the light of day. And actually, they did do some research. They did actually ask some people, like public, and they're actually quite keen on investing money on projects that will help boost local areas. But how you do that and how that happens is quite a difficult bridge, because, you know, at the end of the day, people invest in their pension for their retirement and they want a certain return over the years. Now, what happens if, you know, some of this default fund didn't perform as it was? Mm-hmm. The government's on the hook, gets a bit messy. But in the same breath, you know, it all depends. The devil will be in the detail, Georgie. And actually, the reason why I picked this story for the podcast is actually it's quite an interesting concept. It's very difficult without further detail of how this exactly will work, whether it would be a good idea or not. My first gut instinct is like Danger Will Robinson, you know.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my God.
You know, they're putting, you know, this, people are going to have to opt out if they want it. They could keep raking billions from people's workplace pensions from this. And actually, we've discussed this again on the podcast in the past. You need to go and see what your pension's invested in. You know, and everyone, a large proportion of people might not be that keen on having a look at what their pension's being invested in. And it probably, I would suggest, takes a certain amount of money in your pension before you start thinking along those lines. But that's the thing. If it's an opt-out, if people can opt out of this and this gets lots of publicity, I would have thought it could, in a kind of way, get people more engaged.
Yeah, look, there's some positive things to this, I've no doubt. But I do see some concerns. How do you pick the startup companies and those sorts of things in which to do this? Should it be a default, or should we look at it more like, you know, ESG and green with our pensions? We have the option to do something that we think is right or not, depending on your values. That, I think, has got people a bit more engaged. But the idea of making it a default is, I just think there's just, I mean, we've just spoken to Steve about all the screw-ups with government. You know, just, Tanya, what could possibly go wrong?
Huh? Well, maybe they'll have to make it opt-in when it actually comes down to it. The thing about it is that governments, I mean, especially Tory governments, but also Labour in recent decades, have not wanted to do what they call pick winners, which means basically deciding which private companies, small startups and ventures to support, because, you know, so many of them fail. But it does seem like business ventures will be part of this plan, which means that basically they're expecting pension savers to take the risk that they're not prepared to take with taxpayers' money, which is a bit worrying. Some of it, I mean, like Lee says, the devil will be in the detail. I hope that they will be really transparent about what it's going into. The thing about it is that very small, exciting, innovative companies are inherently risky. If they're talking about big infrastructure projects, then, well, there's other problems with that. It could be quite illiquid and difficult to get your money out of. And we've had trouble with property funds during the pandemic, with the open-ended ones closing. But at the end of the day, it will be really risky. And the thing about it is, it will be a very long-term project, and crashes happen. We all know this. There's no way there won't be a crash at some point. There always is. Periodically, there is a stock market crash. And I think they'd have to have some kind of robust plan about how someone coming up for retirement won't be penalised.
Indeed. I can't see anything going wrong with that one. Lee, you did mention there, because actually you've got some research on your website, or you've got an article on your website talking about how much we're engaged in our pension. So it might be quite nice if something does get us engaged. I'm not sure this is the right scheme. However, talking about how many of us even know that our money is invested in the stock market, 2/3 of us apparently have no idea. They've no idea how much they've managed to save so far. Those people that are the most likely to admit to a lack of knowledge, this is according to Hargreaves Lansdown, are women, the self-employed, single people, and low earners. Lee, why does it matter? Why does it matter that you know where your money is? Why does it matter that you know how much you've saved?
Well, firstly, it's good to have diversification in your pension. You know, if you have it all in one default fund, you're just at the mercy of whatever that default fund invests in. Really, you know, it's worth having a look around, seeing what other options are on offer from your pension provider, which would be, you know, through your workplace. Now, I think there's quite a big disengagement depending on where you are in your life. And a lot of people look at retirement, especially in their, you know, first job, 20s, 30s, and just think of retirement as something really far down the line. You don't need to really think about it too much, which I absolutely understand the philosophy of that. And believe me, I've been there. It's not like I got a job and that's it. I've been straight on my pension, looking at what, you know, what's been invested in, all that kind of thing. But we're in a kind of age now where you can be engaged in your pension pretty easily. You know, you can log into your workplace pension quite simply. And you can have a look around at all of the options on offer. If you're not confident enough, you know, don't go around picking all sorts of strange things for your pension. That's not what I'm saying. Have a look at what options are out there. Potentially get some low-cost financial advice if you want to look at sort of diversifying. Now, actually, there's an interesting bit of this research saying that people are way more likely to be engaged once they've saved £5,000. I can kind of see why, again, because £5,000 is a sum of money that's not insignificant. You know, all of a sudden you're thinking £5,000, how can I grow this a bit more? And I think from that point onwards, people might be more likely to start upping their contributions, you know, even if you nudge it a percent or two and your workplace match it, you know, that you could start looking at some future projections and you think, okay, I see what this pension business is all about. And then that next step is finding out what you're investing in. And that's another reason why it's important, is some people aren't happy, probably wouldn't be happy to know if their money's been invested in, you know, so-called sort of sin stocks, you know, things that people don't believe in, and especially in recent years where more people seem to be more focused on potentially making their pension a little bit greener and it going into firms and projects and things that match people's ethics a little bit more. So it is well worth having a look. And again, I sometimes sound like a broken record, I think, Georgie, on this podcast, but it's worth spending a few hours having a look around, even if you just get the login sorted out for your workplace pension and have a look at it. I would treat it as an annual, either every 6 months or once a year, just having a look how it's performing, what it's doing. You should get stuff through the post as well. Thing is, I got mine through the post maybe 2 months ago, and everything was a sort of year out of date. It would send me about the year before. And I was like, this is not the way to engage people. You know, yeah. This and thought, why are you telling me about this? This was ages ago. This was up to the financial year 2020. So it is worth logging in and having a look. And even if you don't act on anything, you know, even if you don't do anything, it's good to see, depending on who your pension provider is, what options there could be for your pension and, you know, potentially having a couple of different funds. You do need to look at things like the cost of that, because sometimes it could be a bit more expensive to be in different funds. But hey, look, wet, boring summer's day, well worth having a look.
Absolutely. Tanya, I have to tread carefully now with the male listeners of the podcast when I say what I'm about to say next. So the self-employed, single people, low earners, and women most likely to admit a lack of knowledge. Could this be with women particularly, and we hear this a lot, that actually they do know, but they're just less likely to be as confident, shall I say, as men? You know, like we always say when you go for a job, that women always say that they need to be 100% ticking all the boxes where men go for 60. Is there an element of that at play? Apologies, men, by the way. Women.
Very possibly, because in this survey, basically you had to sign up to statements, and they were very definite statements like, I know what is in my state pension, I know where it is invested, I know this, I know that. And roughly one in three said to all the questions, Yes, I do know. And roughly two-thirds said, I don't know, to all of them. So I suspect that there were some men who didn't know but said they did, and that there are some women who actually knew a lot more than they actually thought, but looked at that statement and said, well, I'm not absolutely sure that I absolutely know all the ins and outs of that. And it probably works out. I also suspect with women is that they are more likely to be nervous about the subject of pensions because they probably know they haven't got enough and have certainly not got as much as men. And that is a more concrete situation because women earn less than men, and also they are more likely to do unpaid caring work at various points in their life, not just children, but also during the years when they could be earning the most, maybe their 50s, they could be caring for partners or for parents. And so therefore, I mean, this 5,000 trigger is interesting. I mean, basically, if you're not at that or you're not at a higher level, then, you know, you're less likely to be engaged. And if women are earning less, it's going to take them longer to reach that point. So there are actual reasons why this might actually be the case.
Single people?
Well, single people, I think it's a case of two heads are better than one. Two people are more likely to know between them something than one person on their own. And also marriage is a trigger. Lee is married. I'm sure he talked about his finances with his wife and she talked to him about hers, and in the course of that discussion they both learned things and they both made a plan.
I'm sure and that's that is got very nothing to do with them getting married, more the fact that he is a personal finance journalist and that's the conversations he had and wanted to be an estate agent when he grew up, didn't you, Lee?
The first date I ever had with my now wife almost 10 years ago, and she found out I was a finance journalist, she actually asked me what was the best rate for her ISA.
Sexy chat.
And I was like, well,
we're meant to be together.
But 10 years touches on something there. I mean, we do a probably like a quarterly audit of our finances, and that does include pension. You know, I know I'm a financial journalist, so it kind of makes sense. It'd be a bit daft if I wasn't looking at this and it's not on my brain quite a lot. But we do have occasional chats about our finances, and I think there is something in that. You know, I like to know where some of, like, you know, stocks and shares ISA is, with the mortgage at, where's pensions at. And, you know, we're very open and transparent about both of our finances.
Yeah. So it's the best way to be, I imagine. I want to talk to you about, Lee, you mentioned it a little bit earlier. We've got more details this week about the much anticipated green bonds. Let's go there now. Won't be available until later on in the year, but the Chancellor's been also outlining plans to overhaul the financial services industry and to make it the world's, quote, most advanced and exciting hub as the government targets net zero emissions. Now, the green bonds will be issued by Treasury-backed bank NS&I and will only be available to buy online. Tanya, green bonds. What are they, and are they really green?
Well, NS&I will be issuing them later in the year, just before the big climate, the UN climate summit in Glasgow. Obviously, the timing is not coincidental. The government's going to put $15 billion behind these bonds. Apparently, they're only going to be available online, which is a bit of a shame for older people. They have left a little bit of wriggle room and said, you can ring us up if you really think you can't do this online and you've got a really good reason for wanting to invest in them. So I suspect that they will let people do that. The huge, great mystery, though, with the green bonds is that we don't know the interest rate yet. And that is going to really, I think, determine about how successful they are. A few years ago, the pensioner bonds were very successful. There was high demand for them. And I seem to remember that they were, I don't remember the rates involved, but I seem to remember that for the time, they were relatively generous. And therefore, lots and lots of people got them and benefited. So we'll have to see. I think the jury's out on them until we know the rate. One thing I would say about them, we've obviously had a lot of responses from the industry. Someone from AJ Bell wrote an interesting piece. The government currently can borrow at 0.2% over 3 years. If it matches, say, 1.5% a sort of Best Buy 3-year rate at the moment, roughly, then they reckon it will cost the government an extra, you know, 165 million a year and half a million over 3 years to basically subsidise these green bonds when they could have just borrowed it off international market money markets and done exactly the same things with this money that they plan to do with the money they're raising from individuals. When you look at it, you think, okay, what are they doing here? There are obviously some benefits to getting savers involved in this anyway, but when you actually look at the financial side of it, you do have to wonder a little bit, don't you, what they're up to here.
So what are they up to, Lee? A bit of PR, a bit of good marketing, or actually something substantial here?
As Tanya's hit the nail on the head there, I mean, look, we're at a time where savings rates have really bottomed out. You know, we know that. We've spoken about that a long time. And actually, NS&I, the Treasury-backed bank, is responsible for delivering good value to taxpayers. So it's after £15 billion of money. That's going to fall outside its usual net financing targets, which is money that they get in and out from things like premium bonds. So it's going to be separate from that, which gives it a bit of wiggle room to you know, not interfere too much, you know, in what is Best Buy savings rate. So they've got a bit of a chance to do that. But you could borrow money so cheaply on the markets. It's kind of like, I guess it's trying to get the public involved and trying to hoover up some of that money that's been saved in the pandemic. We've had this figure of about £200 billion extra has been saved in the pandemic. And people are struggling to find somewhere for their cash. My gut instinct in this, the rate won't get set until nearer the time because, you know, we don't know, the government doesn't know, we don't know where rates might be at that point. It's very likely that they're going to still be where they are at the moment. I think the Best Buy 3-year rate is about 1.3%, which is undercooks inflation by a long way, as we were talking about last week, a couple of weeks ago. So it's getting that balance right and pitching it right. But I think that it won't be a market leading rate. And I think they will instead want to tap into people wanting to get involved in a kind of green movement with government backing, with projects that you'd like to think would be fully vetted and you know, completely safe, you know, which I say that because they're talking about things of funding green projects like new solar power initiatives and wind farms and those kind of things. You know, it's not easy to get involved, not that easy to get involved in those kind of things where your money is protected. So I think that is what the government will be looking to tap into more so than, hey, here's a Best Buy rate like pensioner bonds, which became the fastest selling British financial product in history. Phone lines jammed, websites crashing because people were like, wow, look at this rate, let's get this now. The over 65s were fortunate to get that rate back in 2015. I can't imagine it this time around. But I'm prepared to be amazed, Georgie. I'm prepared.
Glad to hear it, Lee. Glad to hear it. Are you amazed by what's been happening in the easy access market, though, Lee? Are you amazed?
I don't know about amazed.
Marcus.
I don't know about amazed, but there's a little, the slimmest, tiniest little sliver of light that is just creeping through the blinds. It's so thin. It's coming through. Look, at the end of the day, again, we've been talking about this for a while. Savings rates are in the doldrums. It is difficult to get a good return. And look, any movement upwards, any little sign of life that's creeping in, we're going to talk about and write about. Now, we've seen Marcus Bank this week nudge its easy access rate back up to 0.5%. And I can hear listeners go, woo, 0.5%. Wow, isn't that great? But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a massive provider. And it does mean that the knock-on effect to the competition, not just in easy access, but this will be in fixed rates as well, is that, you know, you have to nudge a little bit higher when you've got a big organisation like that that can hoover in, hit big amounts of money. And Coventry Building Society have launched an easy access at 0.5% as well. That is limited access, but you can access it 6 times a year. So really, it makes it an easy access in all intents and purposes. The Marcus account is a 0.1% bonus. If you're listening and you have a Marcus savings account, which a lot of people have, tens of billions of pounds poured into that account because it was market leading for so long. In fact, it only pulled the account because it was going to breach ring fencing limits. It had to. It was ordered to. It was hoovering in too much cash. It was too successful. You can go and log into your account and opt in for this 0.1% bonus. So, hey, look, every ounce of rate of extra cash... and if it buys you an extra pint at the end of the year, remember you heard it on the podcast. You could post this then.
I dumped Marcus. I dumped him.
Well, you're missing out on 0.1% now, Georgie. Where's your easy access money now, eh?
That's true. It's somewhere else. Okay, more than that. Tanya, just a few sort of basic tips about what you should be looking at the moment. If you have built up some money, and I really want to say not everybody has, but some people will have done, you know, what are the things to think about before you stick it in a savings account, before you invest it? Just some personal finance 101 tips.
Well, I think you've got to be proactive in the world today. So therefore you can't just sit around saying this is terrible, inflation looks like it's going up, my rate is low. You have to do something about it. And it goes back also to what we were talking about with pensions earlier. Even just looking up how much you've got in your current workplace pension, never mind all the others that you might have stacked up. And when it comes to investing, what I find, having covered investing for many years, is that many people, you know, don't know where to start. And I can understand that in a way, because you do have to do some homework. This is why I suppose I'm coming back to the no one's going to do it for you. Ultimately, you have to want to do it and feel positive enough about it to actually to open up that workplace pension or go online and look at a site which is investing for beginners and tells you where to start. I suppose that's my only message. You have to have the willpower and take the initiative yourself, because no one else is going to help you.
There you go, some good tips. Sort of rocky shoulder massaging moment there from Tanya. Okay, Lee, it's coming home. Not necessarily a victory for England in the Euros, but actually a retro Spanish top that I bought the other day for the Spaniard in my home. And it seems I'm not alone in going retro or vintage, because retro football shirt fever has exploded, says Lee Boyce. I was actually watching the TV news today and it was also on there. Is it the fact that we love looking back to 1996, 82, perhaps, I don't know, 2010 if you're Spanish, whatever. Or is this just a fight back from fans who just do not want to pay the ridiculous amount of money for the replica kits? Can I say, money saving tip that I shared on Twitter the other day, I never buy an adult replica kit. I always buy the kids' version.
It's a great money saving tip if you're not a 13 stone, you know.
Yeah, that there is issues with that, issues. But I'm sure you can do a bit of, you know, haberdashery efforts. And so it is a bit short in the stomach and that sort of thing. So
right, yeah. Know. No one wants to see my midriff, Georgie, if I'm being quite frank.
Wear something underneath. Anyway, the point being, Lee, retro football shirt fever.
Yeah, well, listen, Georgie, this is part of my consumer trends column. And it goes from the serious to the not so serious. And sometimes I like to write these things because it's nice just to write something a bit more lighthearted, a nice lighthearted weekend read. And the reason why I looked into this is because I've really noticed an uptick in recent months in people wearing these kind of kits that aren't, you know, the real versions from the 80s and 90s, but ones that have been made, you know, to sort of replicate them. And they sell for about £30. You know, and I've seen them in Sports Direct and other shops like that. And I've seen a massive, massive amount of people wearing these this year over the new replica kit that's out from Nike that costs £70, that really is just a white T-shirt with a Nike swoosh on it and the badge. You know, it doesn't really look like much. And actually, a friend came over for the first game against Croatia, and he came over in one of those shirts. And I thought, yeah, hold on a minute. There is something in this. There's definitely something in this. So I had a look into it, and I spoke to a number of different sort of experts of this, and someone from Depop actually was like, yeah, no, this is a massive trend this year. It's huge. Actually, retro football shirts was the number one search term on the whole of Depop in the lead up to England's final group game, which is really interesting because you think of the demographic of Depop, which is a secondhand vintage clothing website where you can list old clothes and especially mm-hmm. old designer clothes and make some money on it. It's very heavily skewed to a female demographic. And for retro football shirts to go number one on there probably shows you just how huge this kind of movement has been, I would say, this year. Yeah. And I was backed up, actually. So the column went out last Saturday. I knew it was going to be Italy in that game. And as soon as I knew it was going to be Italy in that game, because it was the last 16 games, so I had to wait to see who topped the group and all that, I wanted a retro 1990s Fiorentina shirt to go in. I thought, that's what I'm going to wear. Number 9, Battistuta in the back, the Nintendo sponsored kit, purple. Mm. I love it. I think it's a fantastic kit, but I thought, this is going to be so expensive to buy a secondhand or one of these on the internet. But I had a quick look on eBay, God bless the internet, and I found a kind of knockoff version for £19 with Battistuta number 9 on the back. It arrived on Saturday morning just before the game, just in the skin of my teeth. Wow. I put it on. It looks fantastic. I have never been stopped by so many people in my life for a shirt. On the walk to the train station, on the train, at the tube station, on the walk up to Wembley, emotional Italians coming up to me. It really made a splash. And,
yeah, no doubt. I was almost as much as if you'd bought the kids' version and you're showing off your belly and, you know.
Exactly, yeah. And then I was kind of like, maybe I shouldn't wear the shirt anymore. People were getting like,
you're just too popular. Blind. You're just too handsome in Italy.
No, it's tapping back. But the reason why I'm saying this is that it's tapping back to people's kind of thoughts back to the 90s, like Italian 90, thinking about the Channel 4 programme and all that kind of stuff. I think people are kind of looking at that and going, yeah, I do want something. I want to be a bit more individual. And of course, social media is king, Georgie. You know, you want to look a bit different on social media and all that kind of stuff. I think people are looking to be a bit different. And I think that's what's going on. And actually, it's inspired me this week. I knew that I had the England home shirt from 1993 to 95, the year in between the years we didn't qualify for USA 94 World Cup. And I would have been 7 years old. And I remember holding on to that shirt and thinking, if I ever have a child, I'm going to hold on to this. What a weird thing to think. I kept hold of it. And I actually somehow managed to dig it out of my garage where I'd stored it. And I got it out and I put it on my daughter this week. And I got emotional. I got emotional putting her in there. And this morning, listening to the radio, Three Lions came on the radio and she was running around singing Football's Coming Home. And I thought, this is my daughter. I love it. It's great. And I think, as I say, I think a lot of people are tapping into that kind of thing. My mate who came around said, who usually buys the England shirt, he's a diehard, like, you know, fan. He likes to go and watch them around Europe when we could. He was like, I'm just not paying that money for it this year. It just looks like a PE kit. He's like, he's a school teacher. He's like, it just looks like a PE kit. Why am I gonna pay for that? I'd rather get something a bit different. And that's what he did.
Yeah. Another money-saving tip, just buy yourself a white T-shirt and a black marker pen and do the swoosh. I'm trying to think as well, which shirt I would go for, retro. I'm thinking Baggio 94, if I was going to go.
There was a lot of Baggio shirts.
Get out.
There was quite a few Baggio numbers.
Does it come with the free little hair at the back?
Oh, it should do. I didn't see anyone go that far, but I wouldn't be surprised if a few people did. The best thing, Georgie, actually, you know, talking money-saving tips is, firstly, hold on to your old shirts for when your kid gets it. I don't have to buy one. And also, I bought this Fiorentina kit. I've got tickets for semi-final on Tuesday. If Italy beat Belgium, I'll be watching Italy again. Oh, I'm going to be recycling that Fiorentina shirt. So watch out for me. Watch out for me. Come
honestly,
and say hello.
That 1995 Wimbledon jersey that I've got, it's going to be worth absolutely nothing, Lee. It's got my name on the back as well, Georgie.
Well, no, okay, you've devalued it there. Yeah, that's another money-saving tip. Don't personalise.
No. Unless you have a kid called Georgie. But anyway, that is it for this week. Thank you very much. Good luck, England. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, or who would you like to put on the back of a random shirt from some random era, Lee?
editor at thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can also comment on the podcast story. And quickly before we sign off, I just want to mention a couple of things about the headline story on the show about the Women's State Pension thing. Firstly, is that the real thing that really has made me upset about all of this is thinking about, you know, elderly people that didn't get to spend their state pension that they fully deserved in their lifetime. And actually that makes me really sad. And, you know, we all have grandparents, parents, family, friends. And that makes me just sad to think that someone had to scrimp and get by because of an error in a government department. And that leads me on to the second thing I was going to say, which is, you know, we might not have very, very old listeners on this show, on this podcast. I don't know how many over 80s listen. It'd be nice to think quite a lot do. But, you know, there will be a huge chunk of people that won't. And if you think this could affect anyone in your life, you know, you should get in touch with Tanya and Steve. And lastly, Stephen, Tanya's work on this has just been exemplary. I mean, it's just incredible what they've unearthed. And it just keeps on ticking over. You know, we keep getting deluged with more and more cases about this, and it's something that's clearly not going away. And to have unearthed a multi-million pound scandal like this is just, you know, incredible work. So I just wanted to say that before I fully signed off.
No, and I would like to apologise, Lee, for not giving you the opportunity to say that. And
it's okay, Georgia. The podcast is a million mile an hour. You know, there's so much. We pack in so much, from women's state pension scandal to me buying a retro football shirt. It's all in here. It's a million mile an hour.
I would also like to say I saw a bit of criticism over the last week for financial journalism. You know, some of it you may say is fair. We get criticised for what we do. But I would say in this case, Tanya and Steve, you do our profession an unbelievable service and remind us that what we do is important. So thank you. And if anyone is affected by this, Tanya, because I know that you've said that you're still wanting people to get in contact with you, and we know that you're going to treat them fairly and sensitively, how can they get in contact?
You can write to Steve's column at pensionquestions@thisismoney.co.uk. We cannot answer everybody. We do not have the resources. It is me and Steve. But we really do try and read every single one and look at every single one and do our best. We cannot necessarily say that we catch every single one, but we do our absolute best to help the people and explore the new areas. We've opened so many new areas up. I mean, the care funding thing is just the latest, and it's going to be big in the years to come. But yeah, that is the way to contact us, and we will do our best to help if we can.
Thank you very much. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps other people find us.